coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What books will you read this summer to make you think?
I think that people really don't have a coherent concept of progress.
Cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, author of Enlightenment Now.
You wouldn't think that a book that defended Enlightenment values and that said that science, reason, and humanism are good things would be so blazingly controversial, but it has made people's heads explode.
It's sort of like that wonderful Cohen that says, "Barns burned down, now I can see the moon."
Environmental ethicist and essayist Kathleen Dean Moore, author of Great Tide Rising.
Even the environmental organizations couldn't bring themselves to say the word climate change, and suddenly that fog was lifted, and it became very, very clear what we're up against.
What will you read this summer to challenge your assumptions and make you think about things in new ways?
It's our annual summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher, thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we really need your help. We really need it now.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
What books should thoughtful people read this summer? Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything, except, of course, your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, here at the studios of KALW San Francisco, continuing conversations that begin on the Stanford campus at Philosopher's Corner, while I'm going to spend some of my time this summer doing some philosophy. Today, it's our annual summer reading show. It's our guide to thought-provoking books for thoughtful people like you to read this summer. Now, later in the show, we'll hear from some of you from our community of thinkers who have written in to us with suggestions of your own for summer reading. We'll also spend some time talking to one of our favorite thinkers, that's cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, about his controversial new book, Enlightenment Now. In just a bit, I'll be joined by my colleague and co-host Deborah Satz, and we'll also be joined by our host emeritus, John Perry. John asked me and Deborah to recommend some books to him to help him get over his depression at our current political situation. Now, summer is a great time for reading, but with so many choices out there, some people just don't know how to pick a book. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to talk to someone who does matchmaking between people and books. She files this report.
Okay, I brought some fictional clients to two very special, very powerful book healers, Hannah Kingsley Maugham and Louise McCune. You'll hear the problem the client is suffering from, then the doctors will prescribe a book, then you'll hear a little passage from that book. So let's hear our first client.
My relationship fell apart, and I'm just feeling completely jaded. Like, love is a neurochemical con, and I'll never fall for it again.
Your recommendation, Hannah?
I don't know if books can make you feel like love is worth believing in, but I do think the book Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander, who's a poet, and this is her memoir about the death of her husband, is just a really beautiful book about their specific relationship, and it's really nice to live in that world.
So that was The Light of the World by Elizabeth Alexander.
He who believed in the lottery. He who did not leave a large carbon footprint. He who never met a child he didn't enchant. He whose children made him laugh until he cried. He who never told a lie. He who majored in physics who knew the laws of the universe. He who wanted to win the lottery for me.
My band broke up after 7 years because we needed to get real jobs. I just feel lost without it.
Dr. Louise?
I would recommend The Romance of American Communism by Vivian Gornick. She interviewed a lot of people who were part of the American Communist Party during the Cold War. It's just really interesting to see how they remember an experience that was all-consuming and that felt to many of them a little bit irrelevant in hindsight.
That was The Romance of American Communism by Vivian Gornick.
Sure, there was a lot of shit in the Communist Party and a lot of shitty people, but the only times I felt life was great were in the CP. Despite everything, life had meaning. It redeemed itself over and over again. It redeemed itself because it had real meaning. And while I was a part of it, I had real meaning.
I just feel lonely, and I feel that way even when I'm with people.
I would recommend The Lonely City by Olivia Lang. It's a biography of several different artists living in New York City who've experienced intense loneliness. And it's not like a really comforting book. It acknowledges the significance of loneliness and how loneliness is a generative force.
The Lonely City by Olivia Lang.
What does it feel like to be lonely? It feels like being hungry. Like being hungry when everyone around you is readying for a feast. It feels shameful and alarming. It advances, is what I'm trying to say. Cold as ice and clear as glass, enclosing and engulfing.
I have to make a big choice in my life, and I'm paralyzed by indecision.
Yeah, I sort of feel like indecision is like the same as when people talk aloud about how they feel about like eating a brownie. You know, it's like we all have that thought, and it's hard for it to be interesting to other people. But that's what I think makes this book by Sheila Hetty, Motherhood, so special, is that she makes it indecision an interesting place to sit in, somebody else's indecision. And it's specifically about her decision whether or not to have a child. So she's trying to root out what the right answer is.
Motherhood by Sheila Hetty.
Whether I want kids is a secret I keep from myself. It is the greatest secret I keep from myself.
The point of the book really is that when you're undecided, are you actually undecided, or are you just wrestling with something you've known for a long time?
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that report, Liza. I'm Ken Taylor, and today we're compiling Philosophy Talk's annual summer reading list. I'm joined now by my co-host Deborah Satz, and we've got a special guest, John Perry, our host emeritus. John, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Well, actually, I'm here to get your advice. Well, mainly Deborah's advice.
Oh, come on.
You're willing to, to chime in. I got my PhD in 1968, and I've taught for 50 or so years, all without reading the classics of political philosophy.
Really?
Yeah.
So you want to spend your summer catching up on
that? I want to spend my summer sitting on my dock up in Copperopolis, catching up.
Why do you want to do this? Because do you want to think more clearly about our current political situation? Are you working on a book? I mean, what drives you to want to do this?
Well, it would be nice in thinking about all the things wrong with what Deborah calls American democracy. to have some alternative conception of how I think things should be.
I'm going to give two books to begin with. You know, so Locke, who's often seen as the inspiration of American democracy, is worth thinking about because he has this idea of government under the law. And that's an idea that is currently under some challenges. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the basis of limited government, what constrains what governments ought to do to us, what kinds of entitlements we have.
So you're talking about two treatises.
Yes. The first treatise is an argument against the divine right of kings, arguing with Filmer.
You know how Russell's political philosophy was.
Oh, yeah.
He says, Locke was clearly right about the divine right of kings, but look, here we are a couple centuries later, and we still believe in the divine right of people to have a lot of money.
Well, that brings me to my second suggestion, which is that I think you ought to read Rousseau's Discourse on Inequality. And Rousseau is thinking about whether or not large amounts of inequality are compatible with our standing as free and equals.
All right, I have another question about reading. Libertarianism. Mm-hmm. My son is a libertarian. When I hear him talk about it, it sounds vaguely reasonable. So I try to read libertarianism. So I started Ayn Rand, The Virtue of Selfishness. Then I discovered something. I did some research. Did you know that Ayn Rand was not a founding father?
Or a founding mother, for that
matter. No, somehow, just kind of listening to Paul Ryan and Rand Paul, I had got it in my head that she was the only woman that signed the Constitution. So I got about halfway through this drivel, The Virtue of Selfishness, which seems to me to have no basis. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like Hobbes. It has really no basis in evolution, as we now understand it, selfishness. I mean, selfishness is kind of a surprise, evolutionarily speaking. Mm-hmm. So Nozick, turn to Nozick. Well, I read the first couple of chapters, and I was ready to give South Dakota back to the Native Americans.
Yes.
But if you're not willing to do that, I don't see why there's anything there. I mean, what am I doing wrong that I don't understand libertarianism? So
the Nozick book is called Anarchy, State, and Utopia, right?
Yeah. So the strongest versions of libertarianism are actually not found in philosophy, but in economics. And so if you wanted to read something, you know, that made some sense of the libertarian perspective, I would say read Milton Friedman, Capitalism and Freedom, or read Hayek.
Yeah, I was going to say. Relative
Hayek
serfdom, right?
Or The Constitution of Liberty.
Now, I have a question for you. So there's a rise of populism around the world. Are there any philosophers or political thinkers who have theorized fruitfully about that?
Yeah, there's a professor of politics at Princeton who's been writing on populism. His name is Jan Werner Mueller, and he's trying to diagnose the challenges that populism poses to democracy. And he thinks of populism not as a movement to enhance democracy, but as a great threat to democracy.
There was a book by Richard Hofstadter, I think, called something like The Paranoid Style in American Politics, which I must admit I haven't read all the way through. But it seemed kind of to touch a nerve that's related to populism.
So there's a bunch of books that have been coming out. There's a really fine book by Larry Bartels, a little bit dated now, Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. Marty Gillens has a book on, Democracy and Inequality. Tim Scanlon just wrote a book on Why Does Equality Matter?
Do you think that any of the sort of founding fathers and mothers of democratic political theory, you know, the Hobbes, the Lockes, all that, the Rousseaus, did they anticipate these kinds of, and did they think through ways of say, will you find the wisdom in the classics that will say, here's what we need to do in this age to avoid a collapse of
Well, they were all writing the ones you mentioned before the Industrial Revolution.
I know.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, capitalism at that time was very, very different than it's become today. It wasn't the age of, when they're writing, if there's even the beginnings of capitalism, there's no monopoly.
Yeah.
There's no really asymmetric power between the merchant class and the workers. Most people don't even have the vote. It's pre-democracy.
So they're not going to help us solve.
But they've got, I think there's a lot of insight to be gleaned from some of the classics on what are the economic preconditions of a democracy. Mm-hmm. So you could think about Locke as writing, you have to, that there are some economic preconditions of our being able to rule ourselves as equals. Rousseau is a more demanding view of that. Rawls is as demanding view of that, that put a lot of constraints, and that see inequality as a huge threat to democracy. And if you go forward and you think about the great theorists of the welfare state like T.H. Marshall and R.H. Taney, Taney's book on equality
would be
a fantastic source for thinking about.
So you're saying to those who are triumphal presentists, the classics do not go silent on us when the going gets hard. I mean, the going is hard for democracy right now.
No, we've actually would benefit. We've lost touch with what used to be seen as mainstream ideas in political philosophy, like 100% tax on inheritance, which was a very popular idea in the 19th century among political theorists, is gone from our political discussion. So I think it's sometimes eye-opening to see that things that we take off the table were front and center to earlier theorists.
So has this helped, John?
Yes. I'm going to start with Rousseau. I'll buy the Hackett translation. Whoever did it, I'm sure it's good. See, I think you're wrong. It's not that you're more morose about democracy than I am. It's that, like, there's these stages of loss. You're in the early stages. Some denial. Maybe it's not possible that she's gone. I'm in the late stages, yeah. Right? You know, I just want to pay for the gravestone and be done with it.
Okay. We live in a political world. Love don't have any place. We're living in times when men commit crimes, and crime don't have a face.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're putting together our annual summer reading list. Coming up, my colleague Josh Landy and I will talk to the author of a book that's on both our summer reading lists, Enlightenment Now, by the one and only Steven Pinker from Harvard University, when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back to the program. It's the Summer Reading List edition of Philosophy Talk. I'm Ken Taylor, here with my Stanford colleague and co-host Josh Landy.
So one book that's on both Ken's and my summer reading list, which we've both already started, is Enlightenment Now by Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker joins us now. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So Steve, your book, I think, is a hot book. It's a highly controversial book. I mean, you could agree with parts of it or disagree with parts of it, but there's raging controversy, at least among academics, about your book. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, you wouldn't think that a book that defended Enlightenment values and that said that science, reason, and humanism are good things would be so blazingly controversial, but it has made people's heads explode, as one person put it.
I wonder whether partly it's because you've been misunderstood on many grounds. I mean, so people seem to be thinking, for example, that you're saying everything is great today and there's nothing to worry about.
That's right. I think that people really don't have a coherent concept of progress, that they equate progress with the idea that everything is perfect, everything has been getting better everywhere for everyone all the time, and that wouldn't be progress. That would be a miracle. I mean, that just cannot happen. The sensible way to deal with progress is if you were to be incarnated as a person at any time in history, what time would you pick? This was Barack Obama's presumably adaptation of John Rawls,
right,
of the Veil of Ignorance, and Obama answered it as right now. And that's one way. If you're playing the odds, if you're going by the averages, then that would suggest that you choose now, simply because now's the time when the people live the longest, are most likely to live in a democracy, are most likely to live at peace, are least likely to get murdered, are most likely to be educated, are likely to have the greatest amount of leisure time, greatest access to culture, and many other criteria. Now, again, it doesn't mean everyone everywhere, and it doesn't mean that everything has been getting better, but it means that more things have been getting better than getting worse.
I think that's the reason. I mean, I'm putting your words in your mouth. Tell me if this is right. The reason you're writing this book is because not everyone has yet fully benefited, so we need to keep these values alive.
Exactly right. One of my favorite data in the book is the fact that extreme poverty has declined by 50% in just 3 decades, so that less than 10% of the world's population today is living in extreme poverty. 200 years ago, it was 90%, so the figures have reversed.
Wow.
And even just several decades ago, it was 30%. Now, another way of saying making the same point is to say that more than 700 million people today live in extreme poverty. Now, those aren't contradictory. They're the same statistic, and it is a tragedy and an outrage that 700 million people live in extreme poverty, but it's better than several billion people.
Well, that's certainly true. But I'm a big believer in progress and enlightenment values and all that. But I want to throw a line at you from Wordsworth. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Now, the point about that is, he thinks, you know, the world has been sullied by the growth of capitalism and all this sort of stuff, and it's been disenchanted and deromanticized, and that there's more to human life than material progress, and that the advancement of material progress can come at a cost. that's, I think, possibly one strand of resistance. I don't think that's the main thing, but that's one strand. What do you think about that?
Several things. One is that progress doesn't just consist of improvement in material standards of living. But on the other hand, if you're starving, if your kids die,
definitely,
if you die at in your 40s, that's an awful lot of the rest of life, all the good things in life, however you define them, that you can't enjoy. If you're starving, if you're dead, if you're sick. So we shouldn't sneer at material progress insofar as it allows people to live longer, more comfortable, healthier lives. Most of us would consider education, knowledge, literacy, access to the printed word as one of the good things in life that's not the same as material progress. On the other hand, schools cost money and books cost money and supporting artists like Wordsworth costs money. That's the kind of thing you can do in an affluent society, not so much in a society where everyone's living in extreme poverty. So the attitude of artists and intellectuals that material well-being is crass, something to be sneered at.
Well, not to be sneered at, but not sufficient for
absolutely not a measure
of a well-lived life, of a well-organized society.
So true, but on the other hand, it does. It may be a necessary condition for it.
Also,
in terms of the, I don't see what's so terrible about the disenchantment of the world, the old demon-haunted world in which you had to worry about damnation in hell and eternal torment, in which there were the possibility of the evil eye watching your every move, listening to your every word.
That's true. So there were
ghosts and demons and spirits and things that go bump in the night.
Good
riddance to all that.
But there is a worry, I think, about the onslaught of scientific rationality not doing something that old forms of human cognition did. It narrated the world for us in ways that were potentially enlivening and uplifting. And I hear you striving to give us a narrative that's scientifically based that is also uplifting and enlivening, but that's a very non-trivial thing. And I have to say, philosophers and others haven't done much of a job at that.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I think the idea that if we understand the world, if we apply rationality, if we disabuse ourselves of falsehoods, then we've somehow made life meaningless. I think that's exactly backwards. We don't want to find meaning in things that are false, in narratives that are contradicted by our best understanding of the cosmos. And there's plenty of meaning to be found in the course of human progress, the fact that the universe is indifferent to our suffering, that the things fall apart, the entropy increases. Evolution did not have our well-being in mind when it shaped us and other organisms. The organisms we depend on for food don't want to be eaten, but we've got to sustain ourselves anyway. There are millions of types of organisms that make a living at their expense, germs and pathogens and
this
parasites.
This is not disenchanting.
Red and tooth and claw,
we're vanquishing them. We're living longer. We're combating scourges that made life miserable for our ancestors since we emerged as a species.
Yeah.
I find that glorious. I find it uplifting.
You're listening to Philosophy Talks, our annual summer reading show. And we're talking to Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker about his new book, Enlightenment Now.
There's another thing. What some people take to be the kind of political consequences of your way of looking at things. For example, you talk about income inequality and how, you could read you're saying as well, there is income inequality, but that's not the worst thing because it's the diminution of world poverty and all this stuff that really matters. I mean, people taken as a collectivity are much better off. It's kind of maldistributed here and there, right? But income inequality is not the corrosive thing that some people on the left take it to be. And they don't like that thought.
That's right.
A retrograde, anti-progressive thought.
That's right. And here we're on a philosophy talk, and I'm going to credit a couple of philosophers who influenced me in that argument. One is Harry Frankfurt, who had a lovely short book on inequality. And Derek Parfit, who has written at length about it. Yeah, it's not that income inequality is good or completely innocuous, especially since it can contribute to genuine problems like capture of the political process by the wealthy, the danger of plutocracy. But what morally counts is not inequality per se, but poverty. And they're not the same thing as long as economies are not zero sum, as long as it's not the case that if some people have more, necessarily other people have less. And that what should engage us morally is the well-being of the worst off. For many intellectuals, there is a background assumption that to be morally serious, you've got to be opposed to the major institutions of our society. This is something that goes back to the 19th century, but really was accelerated in the 1960s. And to say that our institutions have done more good than harm, or that we should reform them as opposed to demolishing them, is kind of seen as being kind of a patsy of the establishment, as not, right. not being that what a serious intellectual has to do is oppose the modern institutions. Ironically, that is a theme that was taken up by the Trumpian right. The idea that we have to drain the swamp and burn the empire to the ground, smash the machine, on the assumption that our institutions are so corrupt and degenerate that they're beyond reform. What we've got to do is demolish them out of the hope that anything that arises from the ashes is bound to be better than what we have now.
Right. That's one of the things I love is that, you know, your diagnosis of this kind of cynicism, pessimism, right? I mean, I take it that it comes from a desire not to be hoodwinked, taken in by snake oil salesmen. But there's a kind of hoodwinking on the other side, right? All these hermeneuts of suspicion, they are actually being sold a bill of goods too. I mean, I take it that you have a kind of a warning that there are, Steve, negative consequences that follow from having this cynical attitude towards
our absolutely, because we have very good reason to believe that radical revolutions lead to tremendous harm to the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, for that matter, and that there are just so many ways for things to go wrong that if you have a halfway decent functioning society, if more people are trying to get in than racing for the exits, if the streets aren't running with blood, if obesity is a bigger problem than starvation, a historically unique circumstance, then it suggests that we really shouldn't raise our institutions. We should absolutely reform them. And there are many opportunities for making things work better and perhaps making the income tax more steeply graduated so that wealthy people pay a greater share is certainly part of that. So it doesn't mean accepting the status quo, but it does mean acknowledging how many ways there are for things to go wrong.
I definitely agree with you, but yeah, there's an arrogance among humankind. I want to ask you a broader philosophical question. You're a fan of reason, as am I. You're also a cognitive scientist. Mm-hmm. Studies the foibles of the human mind. Because what we'd like to attribute all the successes of human cognition to reason, right? And all of the unsuccesses, all of the dark turns to something other than reason. Descartes believed that there is within the resonant in the human mind this thing he called a universal instrument, suitable for all contingencies, right? It can reason about means to end. It can do mathematical reasoning. It can do philosophical. There's a single instrument in there. The evolutionary psychologists come along and say, well, the mind's massively modular. This Cartesian universal instrument doesn't exist. The Enlightenment seemed to buy into the idea of this Cartesian universal instrument. You, as a cognitive scientist, seem strangely to me to buy into the existence of this universal instrument. Or am I misreading you?
Well, I think we've got there may not be a dispassionate, logical reasoning module in the brain. It may be that we combine bits that we take from a variety of modules using our ability to learn to combine. I mean, one of the aspects of cognition that I've emphasized the most is the ability to combine ideas in propositions recursively so that we can have an infinite number of combinations of simpler thoughts and to extend them analogically, to take, for example, our concepts of space and motion and apply them to abstract states.
Right.
Or to take our notion of physical force and apply it to abstract causality. So with a combination of abstraction and combinatorics, we can take ideas, propositions that emerge from various modules and to try to kind of bleach them of their content in terms of physical objects pushing each other around and people manipulating each other and come up with kind of skeletons that then serve as a kind of scaffolding.
I got you. Josh wants to get in here. And then
yeah, it sounds like you're saying that as a collective enterprise, right, as a community of thinkers, we can work together to overcome individual biases.
Absolutely.
Is that a fair way of thinking about it?
Absolutely. Completely. That's exactly what I'm saying. That we have the capability, because human cognition does have this power of combinatorics and abstraction, it can be pulled out and developed and accumulated in institutions where collectively we latch on to ways of adapting our cognition that seem to correspond to rationality and the real world.
Do you think we have the modes of collective reasoning, collective problem solving, a global governance or something global that actually are fit for this? I mean, I think we've gotten ourselves into a situation where our evolved brains together with our culturally developed social structures and political structures aren't adequate to the task.
We don't know the answer. I think that we do have the mechanisms. Whether we'll implement them, I cannot prophesy, but we're certainly capable of it. The means are in place.
Well, Steve, from your lips to the administration's ears is all I can say.
Unlikely.
Listen, I'm so excited to finish reading Enlightenment now. I think it's a really important and extremely timely book. And Steve Pinker, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, author of Enlightenment Now. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual summer reading episode. After a short break, Josh and I will talk to another friend of the show with a new book on our list of summer reading, and we'll take suggestions from our community of thinkers when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back. We're compiling our annual summer reading list for thoughtful folks like you. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy.
So another book that's on Ken's and my reading list for the summer is a book called Great Tide Rising by Kathleen Dean Moore, who's a philosopher at Oregon State. Kathleen, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Great Tide Rising? And then there's a subtitle that's a mouthful. Great Tide Rising...
Toward Clarity and Moral Courage in a Time of Planetary Change.
So what's this book about?
Well, the book weaves personal essays and philosophical, ethical reflections, and it's calling readers to stand up for the planet in this time of corporate plunder. So I have stories of albatross and angels and starfish and broken hearts. And those are interwoven with this pretty clear-eyed philosophical analysis of our moral obligations to the future and to Earth's abundance. My point is that we are living at this pivot point in history, and this beautiful blue marble of a planet could roll either way. So the book is really a philosopher who's also an essayist calling all hands on deck.
Yeah, let's think about that a little bit. I mean, by my agency, I can do some things, right? I can recycle. I can try and reduce my carbon print. By my agency, I can do some things. But mostly, the agency that has to operate here is kind of like massive cooperative agency by collectivities of human beings that are nations and corporations and states. And it's really hard to move those collectivities.
You are so right. The question I get most often when I'm out on the lecture circuit is, what can one person do? Mm. And my answer always is, stop being one person. Join up with other people. Join in collective action. Join in political action, because that's where the change has to make itself felt. And I think that this recycling effort and even composting and all the wonderful things we can do as consumers to buy the right car, buy the right light bulbs, are a distraction from the real work, which takes place, as you say, on a very, very different level. You know, when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Accords, I woke up the next morning feeling positively energized. I felt stronger and more optimistic than I had for a long time.
I had been in this fog, and I think all of us had been in a fog for a long, long time. So many lies, so many false starts, so many people saying they were going to do something when they weren't. Governments, even Obama, didn't do what he needed to have done. Even the environmental organizations couldn't bring themselves to say the word climate change. And suddenly, that fog was lifted, and it became very, very clear what we're up against. It's sort of like that wonderful Cohen that says, barns burned down, now I can see the moon. So now we saw very, very clearly that the oil and gas industry was going to be essentially in charge of federal energy policy. We saw very quickly that it was not going to be the federal government that was going to have some sort of rapid moral enlightenment and save us all. It was going to have to be the conscience of the streets. It was going to have to be the cities and the towns and the state level that would do it. So I felt energized because the clarity in some ways gave me some courage.
Well, I take your point that now we see clearly that it's really on us and that we can't really rely on the government. But I want to come back to the moral question, the philosophical question. You don't have to convince me that we have a moral obligation here. But what would you say to somebody who was a skeptic about this and said, you know, somebody, for example, who said, look, species come and species go, right? Environments change, and some species won't do so well, but other species will flourish. What would you say to that kind of person to motivate the moral obligation that we all have to protect the environment that we have?
You know, there's interesting polling around that. The Yale climate change communication people have asked people what is most convincing to them. And their answers are interesting. The most convincing argument was that we have a moral obligation to our children to leave them a world in which they can thrive, and that it's based on promise-keeping and role responsibility. The second most popular one was to save the life on the planet, to try to not allow the destruction, mass extinction of the systems, the ecosystems, the natural systems that support all of life, including our own. And the third most popular reason was to honor our obligation to God's creation. So if you're asking the question in the most pragmatic way, if you say, what would I say to an audience? I would look at the audience and I would say, which of these reasons is going to affect them the most?
Right. Right. You don't have one that you think is, from a philosophical standpoint, the most compelling?
Oh, I do. I think it has to do with human rights.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what we have facing us with these compounded emergencies is going to create the human rights crisis of all human rights crises.
Oh, I'm not sure I'd put it in terms of human rights, but I agree with you that there is a crisis coming. I don't think people in their visceral heart of hearts see and feel this. It's not like the fire coming down the ridge, right, or the terrorist coming over the horizon where you can imagine and you can feel, right? This is a huge, unequaled in the history of the human world, looming thing. But how would you make people feel the loomingness of that?
That's a very, very good question. And, you know, I do think we have to, as philosophers know, we have to speak to the heart and to the mind, the moral sentiments and to the rational faculty. We're very good at the rational faculty, I think, as philosophers, and I would call on all of us to also think about how we are motivated by abhorrence and fear and love and imagination and hope and all these, and parental, desperate, fierce.
Right.
You know, the response has been so much less than the magnitude of the problem, so I share your frustration there.
Kathleen, do you have any anything you're planning to read this summer that you can recommend to us?
Yes. In fact, I'm into it right now. It's a book by Jeff Lockwood, who's a philosopher from the University of Wyoming. It's called Behind the Carbon Curtain, and it is a story about the fossil fuel industry's takeover of the University of Wyoming and, by extension, a number of other universities in oil-rich states. Mm. It is terrifying.
Yeah.
You know, we're in this time of this great assault on the truth and assault on clear thinking, and I would just call on philosophers, as Jeff has answered that call, to step up and defend rational ways of thinking and defend freedom of speech. Are philosophers out there defending the scientists in those marches? Are philosophers out there responding as kind of philosophical first responders to the lies? There are so many ways in which philosophers are called to be heroes.
I agree. I love that phrase. Philosophical first responders.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Right. The first responders go into a crisis, and we have a crisis of rational thought, and we philosophers on the front line. I love that idea.
Kathleen, it's been wonderful having you back on Philosophy Talk. Thanks so much for joining us.
And thank you. It's always fun to talk with you guys.
It's bad out there. I wanna
Kathleen Dean Moore from Oregon State University with her suggestions for deep summer reading. Jillian from Oakland wrote to us with a summer reading suggestion, and she's on the line now.
Jillian, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What book do you have to recommend to us for this summer?
I am recommending The Innocence of the Devil by Nawal El-Sadawi.
Great. And tell us a little bit about that. Is that a novel?
It is a novel, and it's kind of a fragmented narrative, uses magical realism. Some of the characters that are in the story include the devil and God, and
I like it so far.
Are there any non-transcendent beings in this novel?
Yeah, no, everybody kind of moves from one place to another in pretty amazing ways. The main character is, her name is Ganat, which means gardens, as in paradises, gardens, the Garden of Eden. And she is being brought into this palace, which has been turned into an insane asylum. She's very defiant. You know, she just doesn't present herself in the way that is expected of her. Then there's a few other characters that we get to kind of follow through. There's a head nurse and a director. And then, like I said, the devil is there and God is there. And what's curious about him is that he's a bit of a doddering old fool. And in other ways, he's a troublemaker.
He is just the stranger on the bus trying to make his way home, right?
Yeah, exactly. There he is on his way home.
Is there a little hint of Gnosticism here, that this so-called God is just the demiurge who happened? He's not that smart, but he's smart enough to create a world. And above this being, there's the actual God somewhere?
I think more importantly than looking at him as a demiurge, you're more exploring the idea of how institutions make God what he is.
Mm, okay.
One of the things to keep in mind about Sadawi is that she was in prison. She's a medical doctor and a writer and a feminist, but she was jailed by Sadat. And so it's very rooted in the idea of then kind of how you as an individual are going to stand up against the Godhead, or however you want to put that. An idea is institutions may do one thing, and they may have had, you know, millennia to become what they are, and that includes, in religious ideas.
You know, it's kind of a pet interest of mine, the way our kind of our love affair as a culture with the devil. Because superficially it seems like the devil, that's a scary figure. We wouldn't want, if we had the choice, we wouldn't want to invent such a terrifying presence in our lives. On the other hand, the devil's what makes everything make sense.
Really?
Right? Yeah. I mean, this terrible stuff that happens, all this random stuff that happens, if you believe in the devil, all of a sudden, it kind of hangs together.
Right. It gives
There's
you all
a reason for it.
Only if God's just a demigod.
Well, you know.
I mean, if
otherwise, he's got a lot of explaining to do, Ken.
Well, right. That's the problem of evil. If you invent the devil, and if devil is God's creation, the devil makes things worse, right?
No. See, I think you're missing
Tell him, Jillian.
Something and all that, which is when we go back to the creation story, and we go back to like the Mesopotamian, like the Enumilus, right?
Right.
Where that creation story was not just here's a story about how we're going to figure out, you know, who we are in the universe. It's a story about the people of that time figuring out a way to consolidate their power over their people. So, I'm slowly over the years, I've been turning into a bit of a Mesopotamian and Akkadian nerd.
Fantastic.
And what's beautiful about it to me is that personally, I was raised in a very fundamentalist Christian milieu, and it did not make me very happy. And so it's given me this greater, larger perspective on things. And it's actually made it so that I can kind of separate out some of the rules that were shoved down my throat.
Wait a minute, Jillian, and, there's something that you're missing. Because you said it, and Nietzsche said it, and religion was not invented to make anybody happy.
Okay, that's the best bit of enlightenment of the day. I'm just going to carry that with me. Okay.
So, Jillian, thanks so much for recommending Innocence of the Devil by Nawal El-Saadawi, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Let's get another summer reading suggestion from our community of thinkers.
Eliu, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
What book do you have to recommend to us for the summer reading show?
The Overstory by Richard Powers. It's a wonderful book, and it touches on major themes in philosophy and human nature. And Richard Powers is a wonderful writer in any sense, but this book is particularly quite good.
What's the background study? I couldn't guess from the title what this novel is about.
What's the story of the Overstory?
The Overstory refers to the canopies of trees. This book has a human component, but also has a component from the perspective of what it's like to be a tree and what trees as a form of being, how they perceive, function, and interact with the rest of the universe, but including with people. And you've got a number of characters, each of whom develop their relationship, either to each other in some cases, and to trees. Most of the time, from the human point of view, occasionally it's the human point of view interacting with the trees. And then throughout the book, you get the time perspective of tree, which is a very different perspective time-wise than we humans have of time.
Right. I think that's one of the really interesting philosophical issues around the difference between human species being and plant species being, right? This question of a different temporality.
Right.
Right.
When you think about philosophers thinking about the world of nature, the world of plants, trees, and so on, sometimes you think about people like Sartre who find it a little disconcerting. And then sometimes you think about people like Thoreau and other romantics who thought of it as inspiring. We should be like more like the plant world. Do you think there's a sort of a flavor of that in this novel? Look at these trees. These trees are communal beings. And now look at us. We lack that sense of sort of common endeavor.
There is some of that transcendentalism, whether it's Thoreau or Emerson. There's also a certain amount of Buddhism, where one of the characters, she's part of what ends up happening is she has some sort of enlightenment at the end, sitting under a tree in Golden Gate Park.
Well, here's the thing I wonder about this kind of approach. I mean, you could think of, there's two ways I could think of it. As an absurdist kind of thing, because you look at the human drama and it looks absurd from the point of view of a broader temporality, the striving and struggling and the this and the that, right? Or you could look at it as a kind of nature worship, kind of transcend the human drama. But I wonder about the human drama in this. How gripping is the human drama? Is it like a flight away from the human drama so that you say, ultimately, the drama of striving and losing and it's all just this circle of karma, and you, in the end, you get beyond it. Is this telling us get beyond the human drama or what?
No, certainly in this book, there's very real human dramas of interactions between people, dealing with suffering, dealing with betrayals, dealing with how do we work in relationship to corporate environment, different political forces in the United States.
This sounds like quite a novel.
Yeah. The main characters are very different from each other. And in the beginning, they have no relationship with each other. And then little by little, their lives start having connections.
They grow a canopy like trees.
Eliu, this sounds like quite a fascinating novel. And I was going to recommend it as something that people might want to take to the beach this summer. But I think the forest, it sounds more.
Yes.
Take it camping.
Yeah, take it camping.
Thanks so much. This sounds like an absolutely terrific novel. Richard Powers is The Overstory. Eliu, thanks so much for joining
You're
us
very
today.
Very welcome.
You can find all the books we've talked about on the show today and more suggestions from our listeners and guests over at our community of thinkers at our website, philosophytalk.org. Now, it wouldn't be summer without some speed reading from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, there's a new biography of Edward Lansdale, The Road Not Taken, by Max Boot. That would be a great summer read, I thought. Who was Edward Lansdale? A legendary spy. He started in the USS during World War II, then the CIA. He did some highly successful anti-communist work in the Philippines. He got close to the locals, listened to them, putting them in charge of their destiny, which would, of course, coincide with ours. Then sent to Indochina, he played a major role in the creation of South Vietnam. He did not get along so well with Robert McNamara and his boys when they took charge, and he was eased out. Max Boot thinks Lansdale might have made the Vietnam War a success if kept on. Maybe. Why was I interested? Because of Audie Murphy. When I was a boy, I saw To Hell and Back, the story of his life, starring himself. One summer, I even read the book. Audie Murphy was the most decorated hero of World War II, but he couldn't find work when he got home, no skills other than killing Nazis. But he was famous, so James Cagney gave him acting lessons, then let him go. He was too much of a clodhopper. But he was cute, could ride a horse, handy with a gun. He became a star in B-movie westerns, and I surely saw them all. Huge cult following among boomer boys. He also took a few interesting sidesteps. He starred in John Huston's movie, A Red Badge of Courage, and a movie called The Quiet American, directed and written by Joe Mankiewicz, who also did All About Eve. I saw it when I was 10, and I was quite baffled. It's about a British guy who's stuck in Indochina, being a cynical realpolitik stick in the mud. And along comes an idealistic young American government worker, Audie Murphy, who steals the grumpy British guy's girlfriend. So the grumpy British guy frames him for selling arms to anti-communists, and he's killed. Graham Greene, who wrote the book, hated the movie. In the book, the American did collaborate in an anti-communist terrorist act. In the 2002 remake, you may recall, Brendan Fraser is also guilty. I'd read that This Quiet American was based on Lansdale. Also, the 1958 novel, The Ugly American, a big bestseller, had a character, not the title character, based on Lansdale, calling him Edwin Hillendale. This novel was a huge hit with politicos and helped lead to the formation of the Peace Corps. In this novel, The Ugly American is a good American, helping to build bridges and roads in a fictitious country. Ugly American means something quite different now. Marlon Brando starred in the movie adaptation, not as The Ugly American, who was played by Pat Hingle, but as a misguided diplomat who learns the error of his ways too late to get us out of Vietnam, called something else in the movie. His character was not in the book, and also not based on Lansdale. And I now know that Lansdale was not the model for Graham Greene. Greene was long gone by the time Lansdale even got to Vietnam. But Lansdale was a consultant of Mankiewicz while he was making the movie. He might even have met Audie Murphy. The most decorated hero of World War II meets the guy that got us mired in Vietnam. Let's make that movie. There goes that irony, if that's what it is, right out the window, like truth itself, gone with the leaves of summer. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeyer, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
I'm Deborah Satz.
I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Oh.